Counseling is the process of winning a hearing, of earning the right to flow into the intimate personal life of another individual. We are in the process of setting forth some steps which lead us to the solution and the application of the Word of God in the life of an individual. Let me make just a few observations that I think may be helpful to you as a result of some feedback I have received. Number one, remember, no two counseling situations are exactly alike. Even if the problem is the same, the person is not the same. Therefore, the approach has to be different. So don't think of this approach as a straitjacket. It's merely a series of guidelines. The second observation I would make is this. Remember that the order we're setting forth is a logical, not a chronological order. It doesn't always come out as we are outlining it here. This is merely for the purposes of analysis. The third observation I would make is that you need to recognize that this process can be extended over a period of weeks, months, conceivably years, or it can be telescoped into a half an hour. And I think that's particularly true with you men. For example, a number have said to me that don't you think that in our type of ministry as navigators, we have already established much of what you're talking about. That's exactly right. In other words, your whole process of building relationships sets you up for counseling. But make sure you don't assume it. Then the fourth observation I would make is this. Remember that the important thing is not the problem, but how the person perceives the problem. And I find with most of us, we get so hung up with the problem that we overlook the perception which the individual has toward the problem, which greatly affects your counseling. Now we're looking at the introductory phase, which we have called the phase of relaxation and rapport. It involves a warm, personal, friendly greeting, a concern for the counselee's physical comfort, an exchange of small talk, an opportunity for the counselee to employ testing techniques. We looked at four of the critical forms that these take. And remember, two questions emerge in his mind. Number one, how much shall I tell the person, and if I tell him, what will he think of me? Now let's look at the other four elements. Fifth, we've suggested a manifestation of unhurried and undivided attention. You have all the time necessary. Nothing is important as the counsel is. This calls for some pre-planning or some degree of privacy. We're getting alone with an individual and letting him set the pace. Sixth, a genuine belief in the counselee's work. Jesus Christ set the pattern. He invested each individual with more value than the entire world. The question is, can you do less? Now, it's B that I want to underscore in your thinking. The value of the person is intrinsic. And man, this is rough for us to get through our heads. The scripture says, man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. And sometimes we so concentrate on the last half of that verse that we forget the first part. Man does look on the outward appearance. And that's the way most of us judge all of our life. And we never get over the hurdle. We never get on God's side. I'll never forget the way God taught me this lesson in a very vivid experience. I was a student at Wheaton College. We used to go into Chicago, to Pacific Garden Mission, etc., to engage in some evangelistic ministry. I used to lead the singing, so I was always enlisted for this type of thing. And, you know, you're in college, you're Beau Brummel, man. And, boy, I had the white coat and the works, you know, and here I arrive, God's gift to the mission. And I led the singing, and someone preached the message, and an invitation was given, and this old boy staggered down the aisle. I mean to tell you, he fell 3 or 4 times getting up to the altar. And I'll never forget Harry Solinier. If you don't know Harry Solinier, you've missed half your life. Well, Harry Solinier, the president of Pacific Garden Mission, just turned around to me and said, "Son, lead that man to Christ." Well, you know, you're going around like this, figuring where in the world's a Bible. And finally, I picked up a New Testament from somebody, and I put my arm around this guy, and I'm telling you, friend, he had never heard of Chanel No. 5. This guy's deodorant had broken down a long time ago. It was something. It took all of the grace of God and then some, it seemed, for me just to relate to this guy. Well, I had the opportunity of pointing him to the Savior. And you know what happens in many of these experiences. You wonder what really comes. Is the guy just here for another meal or what? Well, a few years ago, I was ministering the word at Gull Lake Bible Conference. And at the end of one of the sessions, this very nicely dressed man came forward. He said, "I'm sure you'll never remember me, but I'll never forget you, because you were the person that led me to Christ." And I said, "Really? Tell me about it." "Well," he said, "you were a student at Wheaton College, and you came in to lead the singing at Pacific Garden Mission. And I was an alcoholic who staggered forward that night, and Harry Solinier asked you to lead me to Christ. And I'm the man." And you know, you stand there and you take a look at this guy again. Yeah, come on, friend, you couldn't be the man. I'm the man. So what in the world are you doing now? He said, "I'm an executive with a missionary organization representing 27 countries around the world." And you know, have you ever had the experience of the Lord clubbing you? I mean, you know, in order to get the point across, because most of us are rather dull pupils. I've often thought, our problem, man, is that most of us see men only as they are, rather than in terms of what they may become. See, Christ chose a man never on the basis of what he was, but on the basis of what he was to become. This gives you an altogether different viewpoint to a drug addict, to a hippie, to an alcoholic, to a guy who, you know, seems generally out to lunch, partially vegetating. And he's not too good a candidate for you at this juncture. I said it doesn't depend on his charm, his appearance, his intellect. Man, it's amazing how we are drawn to this. And I find myself caught in the trap. It's very subtle, the impression we give. We give a testimony, and this guy was a very sharp man. Really? What are you saying? Are you telling people that Jesus Christ is only interested in sharp people? It bothers me with some of our Christian magazines. Do I always put the beautiful girl, the star football player, the guy who came out with a straight A average? These are the people who accept Christ. What about the dodo? What about the girl who couldn't make any beauty contest, even as a candidate? What about the guy who's just vanilla? Jesus Christ interested in him? You know, the interesting thing in John 3 and 4 is that Jesus Christ did not think any more of Nicodemus than he thought of the woman of Samaria. Though if you had been evaluating him, you obviously would have given him a different rating. And I must confess that I'm a little concerned, not only with the NAVs, I'm concerned with our seminary, I'm concerned with evangelicalism in general. I don't know if you got the message last night, but it wasn't an accident that we were talking about a ministry to laymen that largely involves the upper middle class. That's where our ministry is. And not only do we have no ministry with the lower class, most of us wouldn't have the foggiest idea of where to begin. Because all of our ministry is a NAV, is geared to a person. who can read, who can think, who can do all kinds of things that are the product of an education and an exposure. And it would call for an altogether different program. We've discovered this, for example, in working with Young Life, doing a little pioneering work in their inner city program some years ago. They tried to set up Young Life programs as they set up Young Life programs in other areas. And all of it revolves around a school. You ever go into an inner city and try to develop a program around a school? Their life doesn't revolve around a school. They dropped out of the school a long time ago. Their life revolves around a gang. And that's an altogether different unit of organization. It calls for an altogether different approach. But you go to a country like Brazil, for example, and you see the Pentecostals moving. And the interesting thing is it's the most indigenous form of missionary work in the world. There are practically no outside missionaries in that work. And yet in Brazil today, there are more Christians among the Pentecostal groups than all other groups put together. And it's all indigenous. And it's all done with untrained people. Their training is very minimal. And their approach is very simple. But it is extremely effective to reach that group of people. This genuine belief, gentlemen, involves an absence of the feelings of superiority and intolerance. And you know, there is no pride comparable to spiritual pride. Some of you guys have talked to me about the great dangers of education. I understand this. Intellectual pride is devastating, but I got a better brand than that. That's spiritual pride. Show me a guy with a PhD and he's proud, but you show me a guy who knows the word so well that he's shot through with cockiness, and I'll show you a guy who'll give a PhD a run for his money. And boy, it's a subtle thing, man, because you're trying to build a guy up in the Word. And all the time you're building him up in the Word, you're infecting a guy with spiritual pride. Man, how much I know. And you dear peons, sit down. I got a little flask here with some truth in it. I'll pour it out a little bit. But of course, I don't want to teach you more than I know. That would be devastating. The whole area of intolerance. Boy, I just was in a church some time ago. You know, if you go into some of these ultra-fundamentalist churches where they still got a hangover of the last generation, I'm telling you, friend, it is something else. They will send a kid to hell for 1 inch of hair. You know, the kid comes in with a little long sideburn and says, oh, man, everybody hits the fan. Now, if you can lead him to Christ, take him out here somewhere and clean him up, then we'd be glad to accept him if he conforms to our standards. But boy, if not, we just cannot tolerate this kind of thing. And I really believe that today the church has got the greatest opportunity to reach the contemporary society for Jesus Christ. And we're probably turning more people off than we really are aware ourselves, just through things like this. Seventh. An unreserved acceptance of the person. My friend, if an individual is in trouble, the counselee needs to be understood and helped, not judged. Galatians 6:1. A brother be overtaken in a fault, ye who are spiritual, club him. You know that tremendous verse? It's the Reverse Standard Version. I was reading the other day in The Prodigal Son. The amazing thing about this is that the moment the son comes back, the father cries, bring forth! Bring forth! And we say, work him over. Work him over. See, if a guy goes out and falls in sin and he comes back, the first thing we want to be sure is that that guy's properly penitent. And if he isn't, we'll make sure that he is. We're going to work him over like crazy. To let you know that now that I accept you back, boy, I'm going to hold this over you the rest of your life. I'll never forget that you fell into sin, and I'll never let you forget it. And some of us were chatting for just a moment here. I really believe, men, the hardest thing to learn in Christian experience is divine acceptance. It is always unconditional. And I think this is the hardest thing to choke down as a result of humanistic thinking. I've said a counselee will only tell you his deepest feelings when he feels wanted. He feels safest when you understand him, when you love him, when you accept him, when he's able to admit his weakness without feeling he's either overtly or covertly rejected. And boy, that's subtle. You see, verbally you tell him, I accept you. But nonverbally you tell him, I don't. And a nonverbal communication is far more important than your verbal communication. I had a student at the seminary a few years ago who got involved with another girl. He's married. Got involved with another girl in his church. Mind you, nothing sexual. It was just stupidity by his own testimony. It was just indiscretion. But it was enough to rock that guy to his socks. I mean to tell you, boy, he came in, he confessed it to his wife in front of me, the two of them dissolved in tears. It was a scene. Now, what are you going to do with this guy? Walt and I were talking about this whole area of a future evaluation and recommendation. My friend, if every one of you was only advanced on the basis of having nothing in your past, you'd never make it. Right? And yet we're still doing this all the time. So here's a guy that falls in sin. Here's a guy that blows it here. Here's a guy that, you know, drops it over here. And friend, we're not going to let that guy forget it. And I maintain that we know nothing of divine acceptance in a Christian organization like this unless we're willing not only to forgive the brother, but to forget it. Or else to say, well, we'll forgive you, but we won't forget it. Friend, that's lovely, but that's not divine forgiveness. We've got to start over from this point and move on. And this takes a lot of trust on our part. But I find that the more I trust the Spirit of God to work in a man and communicate that trust to the man, the more he makes giant steps. And the less I trust him, really the God's ability to work in him, the less progress he makes. And the interesting thing is today, if I were to name five guys in the ministry from our seminary that are really making a significant impact for Jesus Christ, this guy would be one of the five. We get a guy who blew a marriage by his own testimony. He was going to be the number one Greek scholar in the world. I was a group of three guys who were seminary peers. We'd have to go around to hotels to find his wife shacking up with guys in order to get the evidence for a court, because in Texas you cannot get a divorce on the basis of adultery. I mean, where you get to pin it on the woman and get the children unless you can prove adultery. So we had to go out and get all this garbage. I'll never forget in that courtroom that day when it finally came to the decision and the judge awarded these children to this man and then read John 8 to that entire group of people collected. We walked out of the courtroom and this guy turned to me and he said, Howie, I pray the greatest price in my ministry. It was the price of trying to become a scholar at the expense of my family. Now this woman went off and married some other guy, so forth, so he's divorced. He remarried. Well, there are a lot of organizations, a lot of Christian organizations, that will never take a man like this, and he knew this very much. But there was a mission organization. He wanted to go to a certain country, and a mission board examined all of the facts and took this man. And today he's ministering most effectively for Jesus Christ. But he's a wiser man as a result of the experience, and so are some of the rest of us. And I think that sometimes we got a striation of sins. A guy can do almost anything. He can go out in cold blood or blood murder a guy and confess it, and we'll make him a hero. We'll put him on every platform in America to give his testimony. But boy, let him make a bust in one area morally, and believe you me, friend, he is out. He is washed out, period. And the interesting thing is, I was telling them about a man that got fouled up in this type of thing. He said, I felt like I was standing, drowning in the surf with all of my Christian friends on the side. Some of them were crying. Others were screaming at me, how stupid can you get? If you'd have stayed in the Word, you'd have never got in it, etc. He said, there was only one man out of all of my hundreds of friends who dared to venture in the surf and grab my hand and pull me out. And I maintain when it comes to acceptance, I really don't know what the name of the game is. I kid you not. And I've been in it a long time. And the Lord is just beginning to break through to me. What it means to accept people the way Jesus Christ accepted me. Knowing everything about me. He loved me without a string attached. And that's not an easy assignment. If you accept, notice that, this is key. Please note you are not approving. This is what we get hung up on. Because I accept a man or the statements a man gives me does not mean I approve of what he's saying or what he's doing. It's the difference of accepting the sinner and rejecting his sin. And I don't know about you, but I tend to transfer these. I transfer my hatred of the sin to the sinner. So I ask you, for example, do you love communists? Do you hate communism? And what we tend to do is not only hate communism, we hate communists. And a thrilling experience in São Paulo, Brazil, was to meet a guy who was sent by Russia as their personal representative. Highest ranking individual of the Communist Party sent there to start a revolution. And a guy was won to Christ through the ministry of Word of Life. Because somebody flowed into the life of this guy and loved him for Christ's sake. Despite the fact that he was a communist. And I find that even to this day, especially coming out of Philadelphia, especially coming out of a Roman Catholic background myself, that I still have a hard time emotionally relating to a Roman Catholic. This hang-up is so serious. See, intellectually, man, it's very easy to buy a lot of what we're talking about. Emotionally, it's another thing. See, intellectually, I know Christ died for this Catholic. Emotionally, man, that's the thing that sent the most of my family to hell. And boy, you know, every time you meet one, this comes through to you. And the same thing is true of a lot of the other things that we face. Acceptance, I've said, is the first step toward growth. And then finally, a review of the facts from previous interview. Not saying, now let's see, what was it you wanted to talk to me about? At least take the time, gentlemen, to go over whatever notes you may have so that you're well appraised of the situation before the counselee comes. Now, any questions about this before we look at the definition phase? We on target here? You understand what we're talking about? Maybe you understand it too well. I'm not here to wipe you out, gentlemen. Please understand. But I am here to grab you.
How do you handle a case where you put confidence in him and believed him, and over maybe 2 or 3 years you've realized that he's deceived you many times and in fact has never really been broken?
Yes, I would say that this is a place where I think a man needs some direct confrontation. Where he needs to see the message, I've trusted you, but it hasn't been worthy in terms of your performance. Because often it's this type of thing that has a guy come to realize, man, I'm the one that dropped the ball. You're the one that's invested the confidence. And I haven't carried my part. We'll see a little more of this as we go on, too. All right, let's look at the definition phase. This is the phase of admission and clarification. Now, the helping situation has to be defined. Because a person comes to you for counsel thinking that you will solve his problem for him. In fact, he comes to transfer his responsibility to you. Very common after the person has unloaded his story, he almost ends it with a sigh. And so I've come to you. And he just sits like a dish rag in that thing. And it's your baby. Not his problem, it's your problem. In fact, I've had people crawl all over me because somehow I didn't solve their problem. So much had they transferred the problem to me. Now, the counselee must understand, first of all, your role, and secondly, his responsibility. And you've got to keep in mind three things that you've got to make clear to the counselor. To the counselee. Number one, that you do not have the answers. By the way, as long as you communicate this to a person, you will only place yourself in the role of an advisor, never a counselor. So you've got to blast the I know it all concept. Let me give you an illustration. I had a guy come to see me a few years ago. Boy, he had a problem. It took an hour and a half to get the story. And he went through the whole thing. He'd gone to two psychiatrists. He'd gone to a minister or two. He'd gone to a social worker, etc. And so he'd been talking to somebody, and they said, the answer to your problem is Hendrick, so go see him. So he came to see me, and he dropped this thing on me. And I recognized right from the start that I had three strikes on me. So the first thing I said, okay, let's review the case. Now, you went to the psychiatrist, right? That's right. I said, did he help you? Well, he said, I thought he did, and he certainly helped me to analyze my problem, but not to solve it. I said, then you went to a minister? He said, that's right. I said, did he help you? He said, no, as a matter of fact, he crawled all over me. He beat me for having a problem. He said, you went to a social worker. How did you make out with him? Well, he said, he did help me, and especially in my family situation, but that was symptomatic. It didn't really deal with the problem. I said, you went to another minister. Did he help you? He said, yes, I think he did, in the sense that at least he was interested, though he admitted he couldn't deal with his problem. It was over him. And so I said, you finally come to me. His eyes brightened up. He said, that's right. I said, well, my friend, you've been grossly misinformed, because I can't help you either. He said, you can't? I said, absolutely not. But I said, I know someone who can. Okay, look at his pen. So give me his name. I said, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. I said, that's right. In fact, my friend, I am so convinced that unless Jesus Christ is the answer to your problems, you've had it. And you know, the interesting thing is, this is the first time this guy really came to grips with his problem. Now, I'll tell you where this is very crucial. And that is if you are working with alcoholics. Did you hear what Bob Foster said last night? Do you know what the true story is? Factually, the true story is today, the number one problem is not drugs. Drugs are peanuts compared with the problem of alcohol. Every major study on drugs being done today is promoted and financed by the alcoholic industry. It's a part of a devised plan to defog the issue, to get it away from drugs, from alcohol onto drugs. Now, if you're working with an alcoholic, the first thing you discover is that an alcoholic is a hopelessly dependent person. And your first task is to keep him from using you as a crutch, and he'll do it every time. I was sharing with somebody here a situation, a case I had some time ago. This guy would come, typical alcoholic fashion. He showed up 25 minutes late. One day, in a 15-minute interview, he showed up 45 minutes late. And he walks in and he cries, and, oh, doctor, I'm so sorry, and I wasted your time. So I said, that's okay, man. Perfectly all right. It's your time. You can use it any way you want. And all of a sudden, this guy comes up. It's my time. Use it any way. You want to come 20 minutes late? Fine. Just hack 20 minutes off the time we have. That's all. Got 45 minutes? That's fine. I don't mind spending 5 minutes with you. Love it. You know, the interesting thing is, the next time a guy showed up 10 minutes before, and a guy walked out and he walked in, I got 5 more minutes today. That's right. One day we were in the midst of the thing, he just come off a bender. He chucked up all over my desk. You know what I did? I went downstairs, I got a bucket and water, and I brought it up. I said, okay, clean it up. Every single thing. I got 45 minutes to clean that desk up. And after this guy cleaned it up in the next session, I can mark the beginning of this guy's progress. So you never let him use you as a crutch. And the interesting thing is, you guys, I was thinking that this morning, I almost went through the ceiling up there. identifying with what you're trying to do. You are trying to develop disciples. That's a person who develops maturity, who knows how to depend on the Lord. And the interesting thing is some of you are doing the most devastating things to develop paternalism. And you do it without even knowing it. Anytime you do anything for a disciple that that disciple is capable of doing for himself, you are developing paternalism. And it's the hardest thing to get over. And some of you won't get over it for the next 5, 10, 15 years. And then someday you'll wake up someday saying, man, I'm selling them down the river. And you look at your product. You know, the one thing about disciple making that's devastating is you got to live with your product. It's just like kids, man. There they are, boy. The rest of the life, they go, that's my product. Until finally it dawns on you, man, I'm not really helping this person. I'm really making them a cripple. Now let's look at this because this has all kinds of implications, and I want to move into some relationships with Glasser that will be helpful to you. I said, if the counselor does not make this admission, and you come to the end of this experience without an answer, then the counselee loses confidence in you, and the door is closed to future help. He says, well, he's no good. He didn't answer my problem. See, what he means is, he didn't give me a little package that I could go out and take 3 aspirin and never have the problem again. Now, why this admission? He still wants to feel that you know something. But number one, it releases the counselee's feelings of inferiority. And I've had a guy say to me, do you mean to tell me that you believe God can solve my problem through me? He said, that's exactly what I mean. Oh, you can? No, you can. You mean God can work in my life? Right. Whew. Boy, this is hard for him to believe. Secondly, it prepares for the invasion of a divine solution. And have you learned yet, gentlemen, that your answer can become a barrier to his answer? God has not promised to bless my word, not even my word about his word, but he has promised to bless his word. You better make sure you're exploding the right thing in a guy's life. Third, it keeps the counselor from developing spiritual pride and or anxiety. Spiritual pride in saying, I solved this problem. Spiritual anxiety in the sense of, I have to solve his problem. And you know, the first time I began to relax in counseling was when it suddenly dawned on me, without me, you can do nothing. Oh, something. Nothing. And I started to relax. And I was no longer uptight that everybody who came to me didn't get all the answers to their problem solved. See, the counselor does not have to be a therapeutic quiz kid. And some of you have already indicated your tension in this area. Who becomes God to the counselee? Some of you say, my good night, I wouldn't know what to do with some of these problems. Friend, I don't know what to do either. Isn't it wonderful to be related to a person who knows what to do? Get off of this compulsion that you've got to know everything. You don't have to know everything. In fact, you're never going to know everything. Man, I've been at this game a long time, and the longer I go, the more I realize that true education is passing from unconscious to conscious ignorance. The moment you make the counselee think you have the answers, notice, you minimize the impact of the Word of God, your greatest weapon. Because what you do is develop more confidence in yourself than you do the Word. It's a basic principle, man. If you magnify human wisdom, you minimize divine wisdom. You're going to have to make your choice. Now there's a second thing that you have to clarify. And that is that the counseling situation is a place where the counselee can work out his own solution with your help. Notice, he's not alone. You are there to assist, but not to answer. You guide, he participates. He's got something to do, not just to come. And this is what a lot of people do in counseling. In fact, the amazing thing is the people will spend $50 an hour just to talk to somebody. Never expect to solve their problem. They don't come to solve their problem. They come to get rid of their problem. They come to talk about it. I have a person that's been with me now for a little while, and I'm finally in the confrontation stages. They've gone to 6 psychiatrists that paid anywhere from $55 to $75 an hour just to talk. And they're like scalps on the belt. She told me, she said, I had 5 analysts. And now she comes to me for nothing. But she's facing another price. And that is that I'm just not interested in listening to her problem. I'm only interested in helping her solve it. And that she's got to get in the act. Now, let me introduce you to a book. Glasser wrote a book entitled Reality Therapy. You got a separate sheet of paper there. You may want to take just a few things down. It'll help you when you come to the book. Because it's one of the critical books of our time. Reality Therapy. Get a copy, by all means. I forget. Harper and Row is what sticks in my mind, but I could be wrong. Glasser, G-L-A-S-S-E-R. Now, Glasser asked 3 basic questions, and these are terrific questions for to use in counseling, by the way. Number 1, is it right? Now, remember, Glasser is a humanist. He is not a believer. So when we are asking, is it right, we are thinking, is it right in terms of the revealed truth of God? That's a standard, an objective standard. Does God say it's sin? Right. Then what are you playing with it for? What are you calling it? And he and I have gone round and round on this thing. Because you see, what he finally comes to, is it right in terms of the community? And I said to him one day, what in the world would you do, my friend, if the community suddenly decided that my raping your wife was okay? He said, you can't do that. You know what I essentially did? It's the same thing you get with anybody who doesn't have an objective standard. The final analysis, you get this guy over an illogical barrel, and he can't work his way out. Because he has nothing to come back to eventually to say, who determines if it's right or wrong? Secondly, is it realistic? And this is terrific today, man. Because one of the characteristics, as I'll show you when we discuss these axioms of the modern mind this afternoon, one of the characteristics of our time is that it tends to be filled with empty idealism. And this is the result of fantasizing. See, an awful lot of modern life moves simply in a realm of the fantasy. So much so that when a person tries to relate to reality, he can't. And this is one of the primary problems, by the way, in connection with masturbation. A problem that is almost never mentioned. We go every route to try to teach a person that this is not the answer. But the real problem with masturbation is that you've got to move into the realm of the fantasy. From a biblical point of view, whosoever looketh upon a woman to sin, the lust after her hath committed adultery already in his heart. You cannot masturbate without an object. And they come up with all kinds of things. I even have some Christian guy running around a country saying, well, that's perfectly all right because what you do is you fantasize a composite woman, not a real one. Friend, that's casuistry. The composite is a composite of real women, or else it's not a legitimate fantasy object. And your problem is this. That there is a direct correlation between a person who overly masturbates and a man who suffers from premature ejaculation. And the reason is perfectly obvious. He cannot relate to the real world. And one of my constant problems in counseling is a person who has spent so much time in masturbation that when he finally comes into marriage, he will tell me sometimes, frankly, it's more satisfying to masturbate than it is to have intercourse with my wife. He has become so accustomed to living in a fantasy world that he can't even relate to the real world. And therefore, what you are trying to do constantly with a person, whether it's a decision concerning his future, his family, what have you, is to bring him into the question, is it realistic? And man, the scriptures never miss at this point. They never miss. The only people that miss are Christians, but the scriptures never miss. They are of the earth, earthy. They touch reality because they were written by the one who created it. Third, is it responsible? And what happens is that you have an individual, you see, who is engaged in irresponsible activity. And he has to move over into the realm of responsibility. Now, I briefly explained this to you before. What happens is this. You have two approaches, basically, to counseling. One is analysis. And the other is a form of reality therapy, which emphasizes action. And here's the person in a point of time. Now, what Glasser is saying is that in our psychotherapy, traditionally oriented, we've been spending so much time finding out why this guy has done what he's done, that at this point, all he is an informed neurotic. So he's got all of the crutches in the world as to why he's a pervert, why he can't relate to women, whatever it happens to be. He says, look, this really is not the important thing. The important thing is now that you are here with this background, what are you going to do about it? And that's where he gets it. What's the right thing to do? What's the realistic thing to do? What's the responsible thing to do? And the key to his whole approach is what he calls a plan of action. The average navigator will blow his mind reading this thing because you will identify with it like crazy. You'll think the guy came to the Glen. Because what he's essentially doing is to get this guy into a plan of action. Okay, what are you planning to do? All right, I'll see you next Tuesday morning. And next Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock, we'll report back on your plan of action. And his point is the moment you get a guy into action, then you start changing his attitudes. And it's got some fabulous things to it. But as I said, it is not the whole answer. But it's such a refreshing change that I would strongly urge you to look at it. And his whole approach is right at this point, that the counselee cannot be passive, sitting there talking but doing nothing. He's got to move into action. Now, he must see the counseling hour as his. This belongs to you. And you remember my illustration? You can waste the time any way you want. Moment you take over, he shifts his responsibility to you. And this develops paternalism. I ran across a beautiful piece I wanted to share with you. As my wife said, boy, this too is plugged into NAV thinking. I've done lots of camping in Yellowstone and the Grand Tetons, and I want to tell you of a true story about the bears in Yellowstone that a park ranger told to me. He said that every year after tourist season is over and the cold winds and snow come, the bears die by the dozens by the sides of the road. And rangers have to come, carry them off, and bury them. You know why they die? They're still waiting for the handouts. Handouts from the tourists. The cookies, the candy, the bread. But the tourists have gone. And no more handouts. And they sit. And they wait. By the road for the food that is not to come, and they die there. For they've forgotten something through the generations of bears that they have been doing this, that they have forgotten how to prepare for winter, how to dig for themselves, how to go into the woods and eat what they have to eat to survive the winter and do what they must do to survive. And they become so used to being fed from the road with all of the free handouts. This can happen to people too. And you know, the more you think about this, the more you ask yourself, am I doing that as a disciple maker? Paul Harvey tells the choice story of his dachshund. Favorite dachshund of the family. Oh, how we loved that dachshund. And the dachshund loved sweets. So we fed him sweets. And we fed him sweets. And we gave him candy. And we gave him cake. And we gave him all kinds of sweet things. Until finally he got so fat that we killed him with our love. And I thought to myself, what a story this is of what many of us are doing with people. You know, we tell them we love them. You don't love a person by giving him things which are not good for him, whether it's your children or whether it's your disciples. The third thing you're going to have to admit is that it's normal and necessary to have problems. You see, the average person is convicted because he has problems. I've had students come to me and say, "Boy, Prof, man, I must be out of fellowship." So why? "Oh, man, I'm so tempted with women. I was out at the church the other day, and wow, whoo, all these chicks running around. Oh, man, they turned me on." I said, "Really? Wonderful. Wonderful." Yeah, I said, "Friend, if they didn't turn you on, you'd have a greater problem." You see, your problem is not that you have temptation. The problem is what you do with the temptation. We sing it correctly. I'm not sure we practice it correctly. "Yield not to temptation, for yielding is sin." The sin does not come in the temptation. It comes in yielding to it. And we all have problems. No exceptions. Seminary professors. Regional directors. Presidents of Christian organizations have problems. So what else is new? And yet we're all in this universal conspiracy to make sure that everybody knows I don't have them. Who's kidding whom? You know, I think you appear most phony to people when you try to communicate this. In a process of a discussion with my students out in my home some time ago, my wife was sitting there. These guys, in typical fashion, said, "Prof, we really appreciate what you've been teaching us about a home, about the home. You mind if we ask you a very personal question?" I said, "Friend, ask me any question you want." They said, "You and your wife are here. Where would you say you've blown it in your family?" I said, "Wife, would you like to speak?" And the two of us sat down and shared with them some of the areas where we feel we've made mistakes. And you know, at the end of that session, we had a prayer meeting that wouldn't quit. And one of these guys prayed, "Lord, thanks for a prof who's honest enough to tell it like it is." And at the end, one guy got up and said, "Prof, we tend to think of you in terms of what you are instead of in terms of what you have become." You know, the easiest thing is that as you're going through your disciple making process. And remember, discipling is a two-way street. You are not only discipling, you are being discipled. That never stops. Do you remember the great hang-ups in the disciple-making process in your life? You know, where you really had it? Hard, thick, fast. The interesting thing is that's the place where you're strongest today. "Man, cut that out. That way I just won't cut it." And you sure enough know it won't. You're an authority on that. But boy, you want that guy there day before yesterday. How long did it take you to get there? About 10 years at least. But man, I'm trying to get this guy, you know, right now. And I think, and I'm just speaking now as a seminary professor, so you make your own applications, but I personally think that one of our great hang-ups in seminary is that we are trying to project upon these guys the idea that as professors, we're sort of perfect people. We're the paragon. And they're not getting the message. In fact, they're getting just the opposite of what we want to communicate to them. The significant step is admission. Before I became a Christian, I had a severe problem in cursing. Tremendous poverty in the adjectival field. You know, I could hardly say a sentence without a string of cuss words. So I can remember when I came to know Christ as my Savior, this guy says, "Boy, Hendricks, now your problems are solved in Jesus Christ." Well, wonderful, fabulous. So they invited me to a youth party. So man, I went to the youth party and boy, I lost myself in the games we were playing. In fact, I so lost myself I forgot all about it. All of a sudden, boy, all these cuss words come out. Everybody around, "We thought you were a Christian." You know, I thought so too. So I thought, nobody saw me. I sneaked out. Somebody did see me. An older believer. I can still take you to the corner, 7th and Cayuga Streets in Philadelphia, where I sat down under a streetlight and said, "I guess it isn't a real thing." And I felt the strongest arm come around me. And I looked up in the face of this guy who said, "That's okay, Howie. I understand." Took out a little New Testament, opened to 1 John 1:9. That is the first time I ever heard that verse. Boy, you know, my friend, it was just like getting saved all over again. Seriously. Just the realization. Here was a guy who understood. And we're back to this again, aren't we? No matter where you put in, you seem to come out at the same place as far as this ministry to people. Problems, I've said, are essential to the growth process. And what we try to do is to get people out of them. I had a student come to me some time ago. He said, "Hey, Prof, I'm going out to university." Boy, he said, "It's going to be grim. I'm out there, you know." And boy, they go for your throat. I said, "They sure do, friend." He said, "Pray for me." I said, "Okay, I will." He said, "I sort of get the impression you're not going to pray the same way I think you ought to pray." I said, "Really?" I said, "What do you want me to pray for?" He said, "Pray that they won't go for my jugular vein." I said, "Friend, you know I won't pray for that." "You won't?" "No, I'm going to pray they'll go right for your throat. They'll nail you to the wall." "Really? Really." Next morning I saw him on a campus. He said, "Well, the Lord answered your prayers." Boy, I mean, they knocked him over that lot. It's the greatest thing that ever happened to him. That's why right now that's his full-time ministry. This guy get up on a free speech platform. I'm telling you, he's one of the most effective I've ever seen. Nobody throws him with anything. You know where it started? They'll tell you. Started at a night in a fraternity in SMU campus where, man, they just butchered him. They just plastered the wall with him. You know what he came out? He came out knowing that he didn't know. That is a real discovery for many people. Now, there's some helpful passages here, and many of these you know. James 1, "Count it all joy when you fall so as to be completely surrounded with all shades of testing, knowing this, that the trying of your faith produces patience," etc. First Corinthians 10:13, "These problems are common to man." See, he tends to think of his problem as unique. And by the way, the first stage toward becoming neurotic is believing that your problem is unique. Nobody else has this. "Every temptation that has bothered you, gentlemen, has bothered others." Galatians 5:19 says, "The works of the flesh are manifest." He's talking about believers. Every believer has within him the capacity to commit every one of these sins. Young lady was in a doctor's office, woman doctor. She was told that she's pregnant. She said, "But doctor, I'm not that kind of a girl." Very wise doctor said, "Madam, we are all that kind of a girl." And boy, you know, it's amazing how many scorekeepers we got on our team. We got more scorekeepers than players. And whenever somebody goes over the oh, there he goes. I knew it. Sad, isn't it? And what you ought to be saying is, "There go I, but for the grace of God." And if that grace is operating in your life to keep you from it, it ought to operate in your life to help him from it. And I'm here to tell you, friend, you don't have to know very much to know. Boy, you've got guys right on your team who've got tremendous problems. Problems in their family, problems in their personal life, that don't need any critics. We got critics a dime a dozen. We need open season on them. We need somebody to get on a team, to pray, to undergird with this brother. James 5:17. Elijah was a man of like passions, but he prayed. And if Elijah was like us in our passions, then we can be like Elijah in our prayers. Hebrews 4:15. Christ was tempted in all points, like as we are, yet without sin. He was a winner. He emerged victorious. Habakkuk. That's one of my favorite passages. I love to take people to. You know why? Because Habakkuk came into the presence of the Lord and said, "Lord, I got tremendous problems with you. I've been talking to you for a long time and you're not doing a sad thing. How come?" You know, you back off and say, "Hold it, Habakkuk, my shattered nerves." You know, that's exactly what was going through his mind. And the interesting thing is, God never works Habakkuk over for telling him how he actually felt. I have a group of disciples who've met with me now for the last 2 years, 5:30 every Tuesday morning. I'll never forget one morning we got together for prayer, and this guy finally said, "Lord, you know I don't want to be here. You know I'm so tired and beat that I could care less. But Father, I love you. And I want you to do something in my life today. You know, the interesting thing is he ignited the whole session. Because the interesting thing is there were many others that felt the same way, but you don't pray about that. Lord, thanks for the privilege of being here. It's wonderful to have this choice opportunity. First John 2:1-2. My little children, these things I write unto you that you sin not. That's preventive. But if any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father. That's corrective. It's healthy to seek help. The Lord did not beat people because they had problems. He encouraged them. He supported them. In fact, I find many times I congratulate a person for coming to get help rather than running from it. The easiest thing to see is to run from your problem. But to actually come for help, that's a very healthy sign. Now, any question in this area?